Welcome back, everybody, to Heartland Politics Podcast here on WVIK Public Radio, the flagship national public radio station in the Quad City region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm really looking forward to our discussion with the chief political writer for Politico magazine, the chief political correspondent, Tim Alberta, who wrote a book a couple of years ago, 2018, called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. It's got so many so much information in it on that relates right to the election that's going to occur here in 2 weeks. And so it's a perfect time to look at the book and then take a look at what's going on nationally right now. Tim, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Well, right off the bat, in the author's note, you make an important point that I think needs just a little more discussion here. But you say Trump didn't create this era of national disruption; rather, is its most manifest consequence. And I hear a lot of people blame Trump for everything right now. But what you're really saying is that there were a lot of changes that were taking place before then that kind of led to his rise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, just looking narrowly at the Republican Party for a moment before even broadening out, I mean, we talk a lot about how Trump, you know, hijacked the Republican Party, but you can't hijack a party unless it is already sort of an empty vessel and unless it's already been kind of hollowed out from the inside and ready to be hijacked. And it was. The Republican Party, you know, for the previous 10 years had sort of torn itself apart and had, sort of like an immune system becoming so weakened that it's almost begging to be taken over by you know, an outside infection. That's essentially what happened to the Republican Party. And I think more broadly, the political culture had invited the ascent of someone like Donald Trump, right? You know, you had this sort of, you know, even setting aside the mutually escalating warfare in Washington that was becoming sort of increasingly zero sum between the two parties and within the two parties. You know, I think at the end of the day, you know, many voters, regardless of their political affiliation, you have people on the far left and on the far right, the one thing that was really uniting many Americans in the post 9/11 era was this institutional distrust of, you know, big banks, of public education, of organized religion, of Major League Baseball, you know, the media. You go up and down the list, and the government is central to that distrust. And there were an awful lot of people who had just sort of begun to give up on the two parties, give up on the professional political class. I mean, it's not a coincidence that the same year Donald Trump took over the Republican Party, Bernie Sanders pushed the Clinton dynasty to the edge of extinction himself in a primary that nobody expected to be competitive. And there was something happening there that was just, I think, much deeper and that we can trace back much farther than just Donald Trump's campaign in 2016.
Yeah, you talk about the failures of the governing class, and you look at it in any fair appraisal, the governing class wasn't doing well, to put it mildly. In the 2000s, bogged down in two wars, and then with the Obama administration, the rollout of the ACA was difficult, to say the least, and the economy was tanking and not really replacing a lot of the manufacturing jobs, especially here in the heartland that you talk about. Our institutions didn't seem to be performing well, both public and private.
You're right on all of that, and ultimately, you know, when you see any country anywhere in the world go through a period of deep economic recession like the U.S. did, it's kind of predictable that you see this sort of corollary rise in nationalism, in isolationism, in protectionism. This sudden urge to sort of, you know, close the windows and shut the door and kind of look inward, and that can manifest itself in many different ways. Obviously, sort of an animus against immigrants and an unwillingness to, you know, want to play policeman around the world, things like that. But I think, you know, that part of it was sort of predictable. But what you also had during this period of institutional decline at the political level and this economic decline, you also have this just sort of, I think in many ways, unprecedented cultural conflict over everything from, you know, same-sex marriage to insurance coverage of contraceptive care to abortion to transgender rights, marijuana legalization. You go, you know, up and down the list. You have this real sense of the country sort of becoming unglued a little bit over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years in terms of, you know, where the consensus was on you know, what was and was not, you know, societally acceptable. And that's always been a marker that's shifting, don't get me wrong, but the acceleration of that shift and the fight around, you know, around how quickly it was going to shift and who was going to be doing the shifting. You know, was it going to be the courts? Was it going to be legislators? You know, all of that, I think it was that cultural conflict layered on top of that political conflict, layered on top of that institutional decline and the economic collapse. Like, this was all just a powder keg waiting to explode, and we shouldn't be surprised in retrospect that it did explode and that in many ways Trump was the result of it.
I see a lot of debate still. People, some say that Trump, the rise of Trump was attributable to economic factors, as you talk about in this book, the decline of manufacturing jobs, and that Obama just kind of stood around as these jobs were hemorrhaging. Others say it's the culture, but I think what you're saying, and I'm inclined to agree, is that that's a false choice. It's really kind of both, and they work together.
Yes, look, there's nothing simple about any of this, and mm-hmm. anybody who just, you know, like, there was this big debate after Trump won about the phrase economic anxiety, and because it was, by some people were sort of overusing it and saying, of course, this was all about the economy, and a lot of other people, you know, namely sort of progressive commentators would take offense to that and say, oh yeah, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, economic anxiety, right? This is really just about racism. Yeah. And it's like, actually, it's about a lot of things, right? There's was racism and racial resentment and racial grievance politics a big part of Trump's campaign and his appeal? Absolutely. Was economic anxiety real for tens of millions of people in this country who haven't seen their wages go up in three decades? Yeah, it was. Look, you know, any time somebody wants to try and distill down something as complicated as Donald Trump's rise, you know, his takeover of the Republican Party, his ascent to the presidency, his defeat of Hillary Clinton in just that 3 month phase of the general election is, you know, a decade's worth of history to unpack. I mean, there's just so much happening at once. So yeah, I mean, you know, without ranting and raving here, to your point, Robin, it is a false choice, and so much of what we're presented with in our politics now is a false choice, right? Everything is sort of being distilled down to this, you know, lowest common denominator choice that you feel like you have to be, you have to be subscribing to one of two notions that sort of represent something of a binary, if not a binary choice, then a binary thought process, and that's not how the world works.
The interesting thing I thought when I first started reading your book was I had just read somewhere, I think it was in The Atlantic, one of the magazines, a theory that this transformation of the party and our politics, the Republican Party and our politics, started with Newt Gingrich back in the 90s. And certainly there's something to that, but you start a little later than that and kind of focus on Sarah Palin as one of the first manifestations of this.
Yeah, look, I do think that you could, if you wanted to really run this thing back decades, you could, you know, you could go back to the Birchers, you could go back to Goldwater, you could, and you could look at, you know, the conservative movement's birth in the Reagan years. I mean, there's no doubt, and obviously Newt Gingrich set the table for some of this. There's no question. But yeah, you know, for the purposes of the book, I really wanted to focus on 2008 as as the beginning of the end of what we knew as kind of the modern Republican Party. And because in 2008 you have this convergence of events. You have the financial collapse that year. You have John McCain winning the nomination and really sort of failing to connect with the Republican base that was craving something that was that he sort of couldn't give them. And then, of course, the person who could give it to them was Sarah Palin, who McCain immediately realized it was a mistake to put her on the ticket. But she, this connection that she had with the Republican base was, I think, really eye-opening for a lot of people. And obviously her, you know, her own decline sort of in front of our eyes. You know, the first few weeks when she was on the national stage, she was just this rock star and could do no wrong. And then suddenly the holes became very apparent. The holes in her knowledge, the holes in her ability, the holes in her sort of political talents just became very apparent. And then, of course, she very promptly sort of fell off the face of the earth politically. This idea that she was going to be a power broker in the party for years to come, and that she was going to run for president, and that she commanded this sort of spell on so many Republican voters, that all proved to be false. She just didn't have the stuff. But nonetheless, it was still sort of proven that somebody maybe with the stuff, somebody who did have more staying power, somebody with the ability to turn that kind of visceral connection with voters into something, more tangible politically, that opportunity was there, and that the old barriers to entry were pretty quickly being taken down. Like, you didn't, you know, it didn't matter anymore if you were a favorite of the godfathers and the graybeards of the party establishment. It didn't matter if your name was being circulated in the smoke-filled room. You didn't need to be in office for 15, 20, 25 years. You didn't need to pay your dues. I mean, those things didn't really matter anymore. And part of this, obviously, was also coinciding with Barack Obama's presidency and the rise of the Tea Party. And in many ways, those were sort of two sides of the same coin, because Obama was, you know, just a few years out of the state Senate, and suddenly he's the president of the United States. And Republicans, you know, as much as they want to make fun of Democrats for nominating this guy who's just a kid politically, I mean, they're envious. They see the energy that he drives on the left and the passion that he's able to invoke in the Democratic base, and they're trying to do that same thing. And so they wind up sort of looking for a lot of their own kind of insurgents, their own revolutionaries on the right, and that produces this Tea Party wave, a lot of outsiders, people who are brand new to the game, and this becomes sort of a self-perpetuating thing in the Republican Party. This, you know, you have people running for president in 2012 and in 2016 who are making their lack of experience sort of their number one qualification for the job, and it's not coincidental that in 2016, in that Republican primary, the top four finishers, they finished in inverse order of their total experience in politics, right? Donald Trump number one, Ted Cruz number two, Marco Rubio number three, and then John Kasich number four. I mean, voters, and there was one point during that race, remember, when Donald Trump, Ben Carson, and Carly Fiorina combined were taking like 55% or 60%, I think it was, of the primary field. I mean, that was telling us something, that voters were completely fed up with politicians, and they were looking for something else. And I do think you can trace a lot of that back to the 2008 campaign.
You're listening to Heartland Politics Podcast. It's broadcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is the chief political correspondent for Politico, Tim Alberta, who's also the author of a book called American Carnage, which, of course, is a line taken from President Trump's inaugural speech on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. This Civil War, it's amazing to people like me with a little gray that how much the Republican Party has changed in, just in three specific areas. They used to be the party of immigration, international trade, and more outreaching, I guess, is the word, to foreign governments, more accepting of foreign agreements, and involvement overseas, which have all been kind of reversed by Trump. How did this happen? And you're, I mean, you could talk all day about this, but how did the leadership of the Republican Party at the time that did espouse those older values? How did they come to kind of transition to kind of get in line with President Trump, so to speak?
Well, look, I think that you can look at this in one of two ways, and to the point that we were discussing earlier, it would be a false choice to sort of need to focus on one of them. I think in one sense, this was a hostile takeover of the party by Donald Trump, and I think in another sense, it was a shotgun marriage. And I say that because, you know, some of the folks who refused to see this coming, who refused to accept it, even in its late stages. And I'm talking about, you know, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Reince Priebus, some of the leaders of the Republican Party during 2016. These were people who, all the way up until, you know, 10:30 p.m. on election night 2016, refused to believe that this guy was going to be the president. They just they couldn't wrap their heads around it. And once they finally could, they all sort of collectively recognized, oh boy, we better get on the same page with this guy, right? We better make sure that we're along for the ride, that we have a seat at the table here, because if we don't, then who knows who he's going to put around him. Now, that's a double-edged sword, obviously. I think the intent of some of these folks was actually pretty good, and I would extend that out to people like Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson and some people who I think are viewed on a bipartisan basis as really, you know, solid, serious individuals who felt a responsibility to try and step into the breach of inexperience in this government that was forming with the president-elect at the time and try and keep things on the tracks, because there was real concern about his lack of knowledge. You know, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House at the time, he told me later on for the book, he said, look, you have to understand, this guy, talking about Trump, he said, this guy, he didn't know anything about government. I mean, that's a remarkable thing to say about the incoming president of the United States, and that's how most of them felt. And so they're all sort of trying to get that seat at the table, and they're trying to make sure that they have the ability to help steer the agenda. But what winds up happening in, you know, 9.5 cases out of 10 is that rather than sort of getting their grips on Trump and steering him, he steers them. He turns the tables. And it's primarily because Trump plays by a completely different set of rules than any of these folks had ever been accustomed to in politics. You know, like Ryan described this feeling that some of them had where for the first, you know, 6 months or so in office, they would often, the people around the president would often kind of tell him what his limitations were, and like, you know, you can kind of only take this thing, this one crusade of yours, this one cause, you can only push it so far. And Trump would sort of continually walk up to that line, and then at a certain point, the president realized that there was no real consequence for crossing that line, right? That there was no, these rules that were being described to him, these limitations that were being imposed on him, they were all just sort of the product of convention in Washington and these sort of unwritten rules that most of these folks, you know, had spent their careers playing by. And once Trump realized that, there was just no turning back. And so, you know, his willingness and his ability to turn Republican orthodoxy on its head on trade, on immigration, on foreign policy, on, you know, allies and enemies and how to engage with both overseas, you know, that was essentially something that, you know, as soon as he recognized that he was in charge and that there were really no checks on him, he was going to do it his way. Now, it's not surprising that the president took that approach. What is surprising to me still is how quickly the party fell in line. And I think the reason the party fell in line as quickly as it is actually pretty simple. Once you saw the first handful of defectors get steamrolled, you know, Jeff Flake and Mark Sanford and Bob Corker and Justin Amash and Mia Love and some of these members of Congress who were outspoken about their disagreements with the president, they were exiled from the party, effectively. They either lost their primaries or they were run out of politics before they could lose their primaries. They left the Republican Party in the case of Justin Amash. So, you know, it became clear very quickly that this really was a binary choice. You were either going to get on board with the president or you were going to get out of the way. And effectively what you saw in the space of, you know, 2.5 or 3 years, the first 2.5 or 3 years of the Trump presidency, was in some ways a 180-degree reversal of 40 years of Republican orthodoxy on some of these big issues, and it happened sort of without a single shot being fired. I mean, there was not this sort of bloody internal battle that so many people had predicted, particularly conservatives had predicted. You know, Mick Mulvaney and Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows, some of these guys who talked a really big game before Trump took office about holding the line and making sure that they held this Republican president accountable the way that Republicans had failed to hold George W. Bush accountable, that was just nowhere to be found. And really, some of those folks were the most eager in terms of falling in line and becoming the president's, you know, staunchest defenders.
When you look ahead, and we'll close with here with two questions, but my first one is, when you look ahead to the post-Trump era, post-Trump, although, Trump will either win re-election or he'll only, you know, that'll be his second term, he'll move on, but I just read a real yearning, like, especially in Marco Rubio's comments in your book, page 600, there just seemed to be a yearning to get back the way things were, but it doesn't seem likely that they will necessarily, because this branch, the Trump philosophy that's taken over isn't going to go away.
It's not. And even if you set aside Trump for a moment, I think it's important to recognize that what's happened on the Democratic Party, on its side of the ledger, is in some ways a mirror image. Now, is there the extremism of Trump? No, and that's not really what I mean. But I do think that when you look again at what Bernie Sanders was able to expose on the left, this dissatisfaction with the party establishment, and really disillusionment with the status quo on things like healthcare, on issues of foreign intervention, on coziness with Wall Street and where the party was taking its money from. I mean, this is stuff that was just taken as gospel and was just, you know, routinely accepted in the Democratic Party until just a few years ago. And now there's been a massive shift underway in the Democratic Party and a lot of real infighting over some of those sort of fundamental issues of how a party should operate. And you look at the outgrowth of AOC and the Squad and some of these ascendant progressive lawmakers who have huge followings and who have really harnessed their ability to reach voters in the social media age. I say all of that because, in a way, Trumpism, even if you strip aside the policy and kind of the ideology behind it, you know, Trumpism, just as a political playbook, is very effective, right? It's asymmetrical warfare. It's an insurgency against the political class that, you know, as we discussed earlier, everyone despises. It's sort of a torch and pitchfork approach to politics that's really effective and that I think is easily replicated. And so I don't think that part of it's going away. I also think that very specifically on the question of the substance and the policy and the ideology that has animated Trump's base, that is definitely not going away. If we believe that Trump loses and suddenly these tens of thousands of people who show up to his rallies in, you know, in Iowa or in Arizona, where I just was with him, you know, a couple weeks ago, or Michigan or wherever, that these people are suddenly going to sort of dramatically shift their political philosophies to realign with, you know, the John Kasichs and the Marco Rubios and the Nikki Haleys of the world, I just think that that's not going to happen. At least it's not going to happen overnight. We're in for, I think, a sustained period of this sort of hardening of of the Republican Party's ideology, and it's going to, you know, ultimately that's only going to change at, you know, when there's a leadership change at the top, when somebody is able to, you know, unwind some of Trump's impact on the party. And I think that could take a very long time to occur.
You mentioned, I have to mention this because you talked about being at a Trump rally in Burlington, Iowa, just down the river here in October. I was at that, I remember what you point out in the book, that the biggest applause line when he talked about the war on Christmas, that
yes,
Christmas will be celebrated. I also remember the Elton John music, which was kind of strange. But anyway, well, I guess you might have answered my question, my final question, because you talk at the end of this book, again, right after the Democrats had won some key districts, moderates mostly, in suburban areas, and that voters may be yearning for a return to normalcy, which is kind of what Joe Biden's theme is here. But what you're saying is, woe to the Democrats if they win, because there's probably not going to be a return to normalcy, at least the way we understand it.
So yeah, and that's the rub of the Biden campaign. I think Joe Biden has been very successful at speaking to a large chunk of the American population that wants a return to normalcy. But I think that he has also really benefited from this animating desire on the left, and a sort of unifying desire on the left to beat Trump at all costs. And so, you know, I would meet voters in Iowa and in New Hampshire and in South Carolina. I would meet voters last fall who described themselves as, you know, progressive to their core, and they wanted Medicare for all, and they wanted open. They didn't want any more, you know, criminalizing of illegal immigration. I mean, they would, like, check off all these things, and then they'd say, oh, but I'm voting for Biden because I think he's got the best chance to beat Trump. And so I think some of that desire and this belief that Biden was the person best situated to defeat the president this November, I think that that has masked over some of that that conflict on the left and that civil war that does tend to brew whenever you've held power for a long time, right? So, you know, after 8 years of George W. Bush, there was this big bloody fight in the Republican Party that I wrote the book about. After 8 years of Obama, we started to see that fight emerge into the open with the Bernie versus Hillary race in 2016. But then ultimately, it sort of, you know, died down and was papered over a little bit by Joe Biden because there were just so many people invested in beating Trump. But I do think at the same time, Biden has maybe taken that support as a sign that, you know, that the overwhelming majority of Americans, that they want to get back to normal, that they are, that their politics are between the 40-yard lines, and that they just want a sort of centrist government that's competent and capable and that meets their basic needs and that stops fighting with each other all the time. We'll see if he's right, but my sense is that is that Joe Biden could be in for a little bit of a surprise, because there's going to be, I just think what Trump has exposed and exploited in our political system, it's not going away. All of the incentives that exist in our political system now, you know, campaigning and the legislative branch of the federal government and Congress, it's all built on conflict, and the money is all there based on conflict, and it's just so hard to sort of get out of that cycle once you're in it, and we are really in it now. And so, you know, Biden, to his core, is an institutionalist who believes that he can sort of calm things down and get things back on track. I think it's going to be a very, very difficult task if he's elected.
Well, we're out of time. I had a couple more topics, the role of the media, Mike Pence, all these other interesting items, but we're out of time. But folks, I strongly urge you to pick up a copy of this book. It's called American Carnage. It's by Tim Alberta, who's been our guest today, the chief political correspondent for Politico magazine. Why is it important? Because we're right in the heart of Obama-Trump county country right here, where most of the counties, over half the counties that voted for Obama twice and Trump are here in the Midwest, and Iowa was the state with the most of them. So it's important. Important times in our country, and they're talking record turnout, so a book like this, I think, is important to kind of figure out what happened and why. And the most important point that I mentioned at the beginning, Trump didn't start this, but he certainly was the chief beneficiary of it, as Tim Alberta talks about. Tim, hey, thank you so much for taking the time, and be safe out there.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.